anything? Yeah. I guess the question is,
we can stop.
Do people in the room feel like they're not going to want to ask questions if they know that the tape recorder is on? Is everyone okay with the tape recorder on? Okay?
Turn it off if they want.
Okay.
Questions.
All right, sounds good. So, I'm Jenny Rosenfeld. Nice to see everyone, a lot of new faces. I'll just, for those of you who are Pardis students, I know we're going to be meeting tomorrow, and you'll get to hear exactly what happened last week. But I just wanted to start off with a couple of words in terms of last week. If I sit down, can people see me or not? No? Okay. So then I think I'm going to go for the Stender, because if I'm reading stuff, you'll be able to see me. Good? Okay. Anyone can't hear me, let me know, and they'll bring a microphone. Okay. So basically, what we did last week was we looked at passages from the Talmud, which really brought out the struggle of the Talmudic sages with sexual desire. And the reason that I started there, so for those who didn't hear it last week, I just want to give kind of a one-minute recap, is just so that when we start out tonight with the halachic texts, it shouldn't seem kind of as absolute or cold or unfeeling as it might. I think that the reason I started last week with the narratives from the Talmud of struggles with sexuality is to kind of put the halakhic sources in context. In other words, we saw last week various models or various levels in terms of the struggle of upholding halakhic observance. Right, we saw that Rav Chisda got married young, and that was his way of dealing with sexual desire. We saw others like Rav Amram struggling, and at the last moment, you know what? Actually, I can just pass these out. Do people? Anyone doesn't have? Yeah. Right. We saw people like Rav Amram struggling with sexual desire and overcoming at the last minute. And we saw others such as Rabbi Elazar ben Dordaya, who gave in to temptation, sinned tremendously in the sexual realm, and yet eventually made it into Olam Haba. So the point in seeing those sources is that already in the times of Chazal, things were complicated. There's another story which we didn't look at in Moed Katan, page 17a, Yedzayin Amud Aleph, that talks about a young Torah scholar who takes Rabbi Lai's advice. That might not be the right sheet. That isn't. Yeah, that's for tomorrow. Not sure why. Aside. But there should be more circulating. So a story of someone who actually takes Rabbi Eli's advice about wearing black and going to a different place to sin. And it's a Torah scholar who takes that advice. There in the Gemara, there's a lot of tension in the story. Is that advice even for Torah scholars? Or should the Torah scholar somehow be above desire? But the reason that I wanted to start with those stories is that at least for those people who grew up within the Orthodox community, I think for people who came or who grew up in different communities, I'm sure that the situation is very different. But growing up in the Orthodox community, there's definitely an attitude of halachocentrism, in which halacha is the center of everything, and at the same time, halachic perfectionism, which means that, you know, we always do everything right and never make any mistakes. And I think that those kind of two things together, the halachocentrism and the halachic perfectionism, can lead one to feel, especially in the sexual context, a feeling of isolation once there's any feeling of struggle or especially violation. And so that's why I wanted to start with those Talmudic voices to remind us that the struggle, conflict, failing are all normal parts of the religious experience. And I think that we wouldn't see that from halachic texts alone. Well, there should be pages here. And if people want to, I don't know, take a chair and move closer, I want to be, so I feel like I can see everyone. So our topic tonight,
sources.
Are there more sources lying around?
Are there any more sources?
It looks like there might not be enough.
No? Okay, so maybe that would be great. Do you want a copy to take it? Yeah? Okay. All right. So basically, our topic tonight is Shomer Negia, literally guarding oneself from touch, which refers to the practice of unmarried men and women not having any physical contact with members of the opposite sex. This practice actually continues even after marriage as well, with married people only having physical contact with their spouse and not any others of the opposite sex. The question also, which we won't deal with tonight, actually comes up in terms of people who are gay. How does Shomer Nagia relate to them? Does it relate to the same sex, the opposite sex? Even some would say both. A whole separate question, but just to say, like, what we're doing tonight is really just a drop in the bucket. And the question that I want to answer tonight is, where does Shomer Nagia come from? What are some of the basic sources? Now, I remember first hearing about this when I was in 7th or 8th grade in a co-ed modern Orthodox day school as a rumor that there were these, you know, Hasidim in Brooklyn who used to do this really strange thing of not touching each other, okay? Then I remember throughout high school hearing, you know, from camp counselors, beautiful arguments as to why this is a nice thing. I don't know if anyone's heard of Gila Manelson, a book, The Magic Touch, okay? Gets quoted a lot. It's a book. I actually came back to it, read it again a few years ago. Not a single source is actually mentioned there. And it wasn't actually until I was older that I encountered the halachic sources for this practice. And that was like, it was strange. There was a practice that I had been hearing about for maybe, I don't know, almost 10 years before I saw any of the sources. So that's really what I wanted to share with you tonight. Technical note is that when looking at the halachic texts, you won't find the word Shomer Nagia at all. It's a word that was invented on a discussion of Jewish educators, the Lukjed listserv, and the question has come up there a few times. When was the term Shomer Nagia invented? Was it invented in the 80s, the 70s, maybe even in Bnei Akiva in the 1960s, but certainly not any earlier than that. Okay, the term that's used in the halachic sources is Isur Kreva L'Arayot, the prohibition of coming near to any of those who are sexually forbidden to you. Okay, so let's begin with looking at the sources. I just want to welcome everyone. I sometimes will throw out Hebrew terms without translating them if I'm not thinking about it sensitively enough, so just stop me and tell me there's a term that I'm using that you're not familiar with, because chances are, if I use it once, I'll probably use it again and again. Okay? So, where does the story begin? We're going to start with the Torah, with several verses in Leviticus that contain the roots of this prohibition, which we'll call Shomer Nagia, since that's what it's kind of so colloquially referred to as. So, I'm starting with the first set of psukim, Vayikra Parak Yudchet, chapter 18 of Leviticus. There's an introductory pasuk to all of the sexual prohibitions. Most of them in the list that are discussed in chapter 18 are various relatives. And the pasuk says, Ish ish al kol she'er b'saro lo tikrivu legalot erva ani Hashem. None of you shall come near anyone of his own flesh, any of his relatives, to uncover their nakedness. I am the Lord. Okay? And what's interesting here is that it uses the word, which I bolded in the Hebrew, lo tikrivu, do not come near to uncovering the nakedness. And the question is going to come up, what does it mean, don't come near? If we say, don't uncover their nakedness, we can understand, means don't have sex with them. And we can understand a little bit more, hopefully towards the end of this evening, what does that actually mean? At what point does one violate the prohibition of having sex? But let's leave that aside for now and just focus on what does it mean not to come near, okay? And is this, in fact, a separate prohibition or not? At this point, we're just asking the question. Several verses later, when the prohibition of having sex with a nidah, with a woman who is menstruating, comes up, again, the verse uses that same term of lo tikrav, of do not come near. Okay, this is in verse 19. The Elisha b'nidat tumata lo tikrav legalot ervata. Okay, do not come near a woman during her period of uncleanness, menstruation, to uncover her nakedness. And one thing that I just want to add here, I did not bring sources in this issue, though, is the question of when is a woman considered a nidat? When is she considered to be menstruating? And what the Gemara says is that not only is it when a woman has her period, but it's until she goes to the mikvah. So you could have a situation where a girl at the age of 12, let's say, gets her period for the first time, and then has a period of years, it could be 10 years, 20 years, when she does not go to the mikvah, during that entire period, she has that status of nidah, even during the, you know, the 2 weeks out of every, or the 3 weeks out of every month when she doesn't have her period at all. Okay? It's a status that only gets removed by going to a mikvah. Okay? One of the things that we could talk about, again, after tonight, is the question of, well, maybe single women should go to the mikvah. But that's kind of a next stage question. Okay? So those two psukim are basically where we see the terms lo tikrivu, a prohibition of not coming near, with regard to all of the arayot in general, all of those who are sexually forbidden. And then that term of do not come near is reiterated specifically by the nidah, by the menstruating woman. If anyone has a question, please feel free to jump in, okay? Yeah.
Yeah, it says not to come near.
Right.
But it doesn't say don't touch.
Right.
So what's not coming near?
Okay, so we're gonna need to kind of analyze that question in two steps. The first step that we're gonna ask is do not come near a separate prohibition? Okay? Or is it just kind of subsumed within the prohibition of not actually having sex? And if we determine that there is a separate prohibition of not coming near, then we're going to have to ask the secondary question of, well, what does that mean? Okay? What's the content of it? Yeah.
So I have two questions. The first is, why is it in plural form and not singular? And then the second question is, like in the laws of reproduction, it's only on the man, it's not on the woman. Since it's addressed to men, should we assume that it's only something that men have to abstain from and not women?
Okay, so firstly, here, in the first pasuk, when it says lo tikrivu in the plural, it's talking about, because it's talking about all of the relatives. So to all of those relatives, don't come near. It's a plural because it's talking about more than one person. Whereas with regard to the nida, then it's talking about a specific person. But in terms of your question about men versus women, what we see in terms of all of the arayot, even though in chapter 18 of Leviticus, when the prohibitions are being stated, it is addressed to the man, right? Don't come near to the menstruating woman. We do see in the punishments, which we're going to see in a second, that it's both sides that get punished. Okay? And we can see from there that if both the man and the woman are getting punished, then both the man and the woman are included in the warning not to do it. Okay? So what I wanted to move to next is looking at the punishments. And the first punishment that we see is at the end of chapter 18 of Leviticus, where the pasuk says, Ki kol asher yaseh mikol ha-toivot ha-ele, v'nichretu ha-nefashot ha-osot mikerav amam. Okay, anyone who does any of the aforementioned abominations that are listed in chapter 18 of Leviticus will be cut off from their people. Okay, what that's known as in halachic language is the punishment of karet. It can be translated as being cut off. It can be translated as spiritual excision. What is it actually? I'm not really sure. It's a punishment that's seen as extremely severe, but it's something that's left in the hands of God. Okay, so it's not something that corresponds with an actual kind of verdict that would be carried out against the person. It's something that's kind of remains on a person's record, and it's something that God will then, you know, take into account. So that's kind of a general pasuk that says that anyone who violates anything on the above list is going to receive the punishment of karet. And then we see reiterated in chapter 20 of Leviticus, when all the punishments are mentioned kind of for each of the specific relatives and each of the specific violations of the arayot, that it specifically says that a man who sleeps with a menstruating woman, v'nichretu shnehem mikerev amam, both of them will receive the punishment of karet. Okay? So that punishment is something that's said broadly as referring to all of the arayot, and then it's repeated again specifically with regard to a man and woman who have sex when the woman has her period. Okay? But the question that I want to ask at this point is a question to kind of keep in the back of our minds, is taking this back to lo tikrivu, right, do not come near, we ask, is there a separate prohibition of not coming near? And if there is a separate prohibition, we're going to also have to ask the question of, would one who violates that receive the punishment of kareh? Okay? At what point does that punishment kick in? Is it upon violation of gilui arayot, of actually having sex with one of the forbidden people? Or does it kick in at the earlier stage of even just coming near? Okay? So it's kind of a question. We'll come back. We'll see an answer to it in a few minutes. Okay? So these are the basic psukim from the Torah. And where I want to move now is to the question of, what does lo tikrivu mean? Okay, do not come near. And is it actually an independent prohibition or not? Okay, so we see in different texts, we're going to see a few different opinions. We'll start with the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, where we see the following. Rabbi Chiya bar Ada b'shem Rabbi Chanina, ve'eli shabani dat tumata lo tikrav legalot erbata. Okay, Rabbi Chiya bar Ada quotes this pasuk, okay, that we've seen, that one should not come near to uncovering the nakedness of a menstruating woman. Amar Rabbi Yossi be Rabbi Bun, hi bal tikrav, hi bal tegale. Okay, so Rabbi Yossi, the son of Rabbi Bun, those who learn the Babylonian Talmud, it's the same as Rabbi Yossi bar Avin, says that not coming near and not uncovering are synonymous. What does that mean? It means that there's no independent prohibition of lo tikrivu. Okay, for our purposes, Shomer Negia would not exist, or if it existed, this would certainly not be its source. Okay, because according to the Yerushalmi, when it says lo tikrivu legalot erva, do not come near to uncovering nakedness, the Yerushalmi understands it as don't come near to uncovering nakedness as being one broad violation of don't uncover nakedness. Yeah.
Is synonymous necessarily the correct translation? I'm only asking in terms of if you can't go near, you definitely can't uncover the nakedness. You can get a chance to.
No, the way that he says it is he bal tikrav, he bal tegale. And by the way, you can argue with most of the translations since most of them are just my own. Literally, it would mean this is not coming near. This is not uncovering. And the way that that gets understood is, since not uncovering is a term that we understand, okay, we know what it means, we say, okay, lo tikrav means that. Okay? So, in other words, it's not like we'll go in the previous direction, like you're asking. Okay? Yeah?
Is this only when she's menstruating?
Okay, so like I said at the beginning, it's when it's as long as she has menstruated once and not yet gone to the mikvah.
But so far we haven't seen a prohibition to someone a woman who is ritually pure, like in uncovering her nakedness.
Exactly. That's next week. Okay. Next week, right where we're going to leave off with this week is kind of hopefully finishing up the question of nida. And next week we'll ask the question of, okay, let's assume the woman went to the mikvah. Is there then going to be an independent prohibition? Okay. Yeah.
Where do we understand the definition of uncovering?
Okay, so what does it actually mean to uncover? Now I'm loosely translating it as having sex. We're going to see later on, actually we're not even going to see it inside, I'm going to refer to it, and if you want, I'm happy to bring it next week, a Rambam where he defines what it is, okay? And he gets it from the various Gemaras that talk about it. Yeah?
Is it the same word in Hebrew as Noah's sons uncover him?
Repeat the question?
Don't Noah's sons see him naked? And I thought the translation was about uncovering his nakedness or covering it.
It's, the truth is, I don't remember that pasuk to know if it's exactly the same word that's used. Someone else remembers it, they can answer.
I think it is,
but I just don't want to, not 100% sure. Okay? Though again, though there, what the sons did to him versus what's happening here is not exactly the same thing. Okay, because there's a dispute there in terms of what exactly did they even do. Yeah.
If they mean the same thing, then why the repetition?
Right. So the thing is, it doesn't necessarily have to be a question. In other words, sometimes when we're learning psukim, we'll say, okay, why is this repeated? Sometimes we'll say, this is just the way that we speak, and that's why it's said that way. They think for the Yerushalmi, I don't think that they have a problem with that. They're saying, you know, don't come near to uncovering the nakedness. It means don't uncover the nakedness. If you want to ask, okay, so why is that extra word in the Torah, right? We could have taken out the word tikrivu, since it's not really adding anything. I don't know. The Yerushalmi doesn't answer that question. Okay? But what I would answer, kind of based on other places, I would say, this is just a manner of speaking, right? So, like, that's how it was said. Okay? All right. So, that's the Yerushalmi. Okay? Now, a different approach gets taken in the Sifra. Okay? Sifra is a Midrash on Sefer Vayikra. And the Midrash looks really at the two psukim that we saw earlier and kind of plays them one off the other. Okay, so we'll look at that now. The Elisha benidat tumata lo tikrav legalot ervata, ainli ela shelo yigale, minayin shelo tikrav. So basically, the Midrash quotes the pasuk, right? Don't come near to uncovering the nakedness of a menstruating woman. And it says, well, we only see that you shouldn't uncover the nakedness. How do we know that you also shouldn't come near? Talmud Lomar, Lo Tikrav. Well, the Pasuk actually also says, don't come near. So then the Midrash asks, Ein li ela nida, bal tikrav, bal tegale. Minayin l'chol ha'arayot, bal tikravu, bal tegalu. So they say, from that pasuk, the pasuk that talks about the menstruating woman, we would only learn that specifically with a menstruating woman, there are two prohibitions, not coming near and not uncovering. But how do we know that with the rest of the arayot, the rest of those who are sexually forbidden, one is also prohibited, both from coming near and from uncovering their nakedness? Talmud Lomar, lo tikrivu legalot. Okay? So then they bring the pasuk that is quoted earlier, pasuk vav, earlier in the chapter, which is said as an introduction to all of the arayot, which also uses the lo tikrivu. Okay? And there too it says, lo tikrivu legalot erva. So both don't come near and don't uncover. So basically, what this midrash does is really separates between the coming near and the uncovering to say we in fact have two separate prohibitions and not just one. Okay? Once we have two separate prohibitions, then we can start asking the question of, well, what's the content, right? What is the prohibition of not coming near look like? Okay? And the next source that we'll look at, which is from the Avot de Rabbi Natan, one of the minor tractates, is going to actually start to give us some of that content. Okay, so the Avot Rabbi Natan says as follows. Ezehu siag shasta Torah l'dvareha. Okay, what is an example of the Torah making a fence upon its own commandments, right? The Torah making a fence around itself. Harehu omer ve'elisha benidat tumata lo tikrav. Okay, the pasuk says, don't come near a menstruating woman. Yachol yichabkena v'inashkena v'yedaber imad dvarim b'teilim. Okay, could it be, right, that even though one is not actually allowed to have sex with her, he could hug her and kiss her and tell her sweet nothings? It's the best translation I could come up with. Talmud lomar lo tikrav. Okay, the pasuk says, don't come near. Okay, so we see here, what's the content of coming near? It's hugging, it's kissing, it's having a certain type of flirtatious conversation, let's say. And then the Avot Rabbi Natan goes on. Yachol tishanimo bibgadeha al hamita tamud lomar lo tikrav. Okay? Could it be that she can sleep with him wearing clothing in the same bed, right, as long as they don't actually have sex? No, that's why the pasuk says, don't come near. Okay, so if we were to stop now after the Avot Rabbi Natan and say, what is this thing that's known as Shomer Negiah? I would say so far we have four concrete examples, okay? One is sleeping together in the same bed wearing clothing, hugging, kissing, and a certain type of flirtatious conversation, okay? Which is interesting because that last one, in terms of the conversation, doesn't actually involve any physical contact at all, necessarily. Okay? But yet, that gets included in lo tikrav, in not coming near, because it's seen as something that can eventually lead to sexual contact.
Or can we just translate lo tikrav as to not establish intimacy?
You're saying based on this, based on the way that it, we could.
I mean, all of that is a reflection of intimate space, whether it's wording or physical. So
right.
Perhaps that's the transition they're getting at.
Right. In other words, don't come close, don't establish an intimate relationship, which would then make the next step possible.
All I'm
right.
saying is,
mm-hmm.
lo tikrav, a
right.
potential translation
right.
is, do
okay.
not create intimacy.
Okay, that's yeah, definitely a potential translation. Okay, where I want to move now, okay, is back to the Gemara, okay, to a Gemara in Masachet Shabbat, page 13a. Where a question gets asked specifically about a menstruating woman and her husband, whether they can sleep together clothed. Okay, in the times of the Gemara, the custom was that people would sleep together, everyone would sleep, even the whole family in a bed, without wearing any clothing. Okay, so the question gets asked, when a woman is in Nida, can she sleep with her husband if they're both wearing clothes? Okay, because there's some type of shinoi, some type of difference from the regular practice. So is it okay for them to still sleep together in the same bed if they're wearing clothes? Okay, and the Gemara gives a long, various series of potential answers. Okay, it then settles on an answer which says, no, they can't actually sleep together in the same bed even if they're clothed. Okay, because of a comparison in a verse between the wife of one's neighbor and one's wife who is Nida, we say just like with one's neighbor's wife, okay, you can't sleep together in a bed even if you're wearing clothes, so too your own wife who is a Nida, you can't sleep together in the same bed even if you're wearing clothes, okay? I'm not going to read that part in the Gemara just because of time. I'm going to pick up with Upliga de Rabbi Padat, which is right before the underlined passage, okay? This opinion, which basically says that a husband and wife, when the wife is in Nida, can't sleep together clothed, argues with the position of Rabbi Padat, okay? And it's the position of Rabbi Padat that I want us to see. De'amar Rabbi Padat, lo asra Torah ela kurva shel gilui arayot bilvad. Shne'emar ish ish el kol she'er b'saro lo tikrevu legalot erba. Rabbi Padat was of the opinion that the only prohibition that the Torah made was on coming near that involved actually having sex. Okay? So, and he quotes the pasuk, ish ish el kol she'er b'saro lo tikrevu legalot erba. Basically interpreting the pasuk the same way as the Yerushalmi, which is lo tikrevu, don't come near, is not a separate prohibition, but rather it's leading into what the prohibition is. Don't come near to uncovering the nakedness. But the only thing that's actually prohibited biblically is uncovering the nakedness. Okay? So I'm bringing the opinion of Rabbi Padat so that we see, on the one hand, we have the Sifra, and we have the Avot Rabbi Natan, who see lo tikrevu and lo tigale as being two separate prohibitions. And on the other hand, we have the Yerushalmi and the position of Rabbi Padat here in the Gemara Shabbat, who say, no, there's only one prohibition, which is not to actually have intercourse, and the lo tikrav is kind of leading into it, but not creating a separate prohibition. Okay? I'll just read the next couple of lines because it gives an example, and we'll come back to this in a few minutes. Ula, ki hava ati mi bei rav, hava menashe kle, lachvate abe chadaihu, v'amri la abe yadaihu. When Ula would come back from his yeshiva, from learning for an extended period, he would kiss his sisters, either on their chest or on their hand. Now the chest, I can't explain, it's obviously a cultural reference that does not make any sense today. But the practice, you know, as today in France, you know, kissing on both cheeks in Europe, that could have been the practice then, either on their chest or on their hands. But the point being, okay, that Ula, another one of the Amoraim, clearly followed the position of Rabbi Pedah, right? Because had he not followed that position, okay, his sisters are one of the Arayot, one of the relatives who are sexually forbidden to him, okay? So if he thought that there was an independent prohibition of not coming near, which meant not kissing, okay, he would not have kissed his sisters. So clearly, the position of Rabbi Pedah is at least accepted by Ula. Got it? Okay. What?
It runs into difficulty.
Yeah,
because of the mother
right.
and child. Whatever the opinions that Krava includes all kinds of even people, Benisha, even hugging and kissing, still halachically a mother and child are allowed to
That eventually, it's true, does break down specifically with regard to the parents, in terms of the halachic sources saying that it's okay for there to be physical closeness between parents and kids, even though they are prohibited to each other by the arayot. It doesn't necessarily break down with regard to siblings. Now, I'm aware, obviously, in the modern context, I don't know that that there are many people who observe that, in other words, who wouldn't hug or kiss their siblings, but it's definitely something that is still on the books, and certainly with extended family, it's written, okay? Again, sociological question of, you know, what gets observed or what's the culture of being in a family today is a separate question, okay? But that's where this Gemara leaves off with the opinion of Rabbi Pedah and with the fact that Ula agreed with it. Now Ula runs into a contradiction, but we're not gonna deal with that now. We're gonna move forward.
So
any questions, comments? Yeah.
After Ula's contradiction, what's the conclusion of the Gemara per se?
Well, the conclusion of the I would say two things. One is, what's the conclusion of the Gemara with regard to Rabbi Pedah?
Yeah.
Okay. So the Gemara had asked a question: is it okay for a menstruating woman to sleep in the same bed with her husband while they're both wearing clothes? And the Gemara had answered that question as no. Okay? The Gemara answered it. It brought a pasuk. It said, we compare, right, one's neighbor's wife to one's own wife who is in nida, and with both of them, it is prohibited to sleep in the same bed, even if they're clothed. And the Gemara then said, Shma Mina, right, which is kind of like a stamp of, okay, we learn it, and that's the end of it. And the Gemara adds on kind of as an afterthought, by the way, this argues with the position of Rabbi Pedah. So I guess I would say two things. The first thing is, when we're actually trying to get to the halakha l'maaseh, what do we actually do? It seems as if we don't rule according to Rabbi Pedah. However, Rabbi Pedah's position as a da'at yachid, as a minor opinion, as a lone voice, is preserved, and it is not rejected. Okay? So it's kind of in an intermediate position. It's not accepted as normative, but it is within the canon, and it's left there and not rejected either. Okay? And that's another thing. Maybe I'll just like use this for 2 seconds to make a point. Part of the reason why I want to bring out the various opinions to show the position of Rabbi Pedah, even if it's not necessarily accepted as mainstream halacha, is because I think that when we're learning halacha, I know that there's a tremendous range of people sitting in this room, okay? Age-wise, background-wise, I'm sure also in terms of relationship to halacha. And one of the things that I feel is important, and it's something that I learned from Professor Daniel Boyarin, is that when we're looking through the Talmud especially, there's so much of the argumentation and so much of the rejected opinions that get preserved. And the question is, you know, why are they preserved? And like him, I believe that they're preserved for a reason. And I think that if there's a voice that didn't speak in, you know, to the normative halakha, or that didn't speak at a certain time or place, it doesn't mean that it can't be resurrected in some way to speak to us today. Okay? Now, am I saying that we should change the halakha and now say, okay, now we're paskening like Rabbi Padat? No. But what I am saying is that I think it's an important voice to have in one's head, because everyone is going to make different choices in this realm. And the choices, I think, on some level, are going to be about navigating between the contingencies or exigencies of daily life and the halachic sources. And I think that in having that conversation in one's head, the more sources that are there, the better. Okay, because I think that there's more to draw on. I'll leave it at, like, I feel like it's a discussion that could kind of become a much longer discussion about kind of approach to halacha and kind of integrating halacha into one's life. But I'll just kind of say that for now. Okay, so where I want to move next is to kind of later sources, okay? We've looked at earlier sources. We're now moving to the period of the Rishonim. And we're going to look at a famous halachic dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban on the status of Lo Tikrivu. Yeah?
Is this considered to be a moral law, or is this considered to be a technical law? Like, a technical law would be, you know, not to eat certain types of food, and a moral law would be not to murder.
Right. So the thing is, it's a big question, because with almost every law, you could argue that it's either moral or technical, and there are those who would argue about all the laws that we should see them all as technical or all as moral. I think that if I had to break it down, I would say that the issues of tonight being issues of Midah would fall more into the technical category. The issues that we'll look at next week, where we say, okay, well, let's say an unmarried woman has gone to the mikvah and there's no nida issue, is there some prohibition that remains? I think that that will be more of a moral issue. But it's not a dichotomy that we have to make. Okay? Yeah?
Well, that's interesting that you say it's technical, because if you look at it in the context of Vayikra and everything else it's listed with, you would probably see incest as a moral thing. And
okay,
what jumps out at me from that list is that it's pretty much all the sexual taboos, right? Like incest,
right,
or all the relationships that are taboo.
Mm-hmm.
Homosexuality, certainly in that context, and
mm-hmm,
in some context today, is...
Bestiality is also there, yeah.
And it, exactly, and it makes you wonder, well, maybe there's something very taboo about menstruation in the biblical context,
mm-hmm,
and maybe it was, like, moral. Like, it's immoral to come close to a woman who's menstruating, but there's something very taboo about her.
Right.
And that would bring in the question of why, and it's also interesting because all the sources we saw last week,
mm-hmm,
where there was sort of like a softer, more understanding, you know, transgressing these prohibitions, no one was suggesting that we be soft with someone who transgresses, as far as,
right,
I understood,
right,
you know, incest or someone who's sexually,
right,
menstruating woman.
Right.
And so then you have to wonder, like, maybe there is some moral valence.
Right, no, 100%. And one of the sources that we'll see, not this week, but next week, hopefully, is that there, you know, some tried to say that the prostitutes at the time of the Gemara actually only functioned as prostitutes when they weren't in Nida. That even the prostitutes observed the laws of menstrual purity, such that the things that we were talking about last week in terms of the sexual violations were, you know, weren't on the level that we're talking about tonight. So it's definitely an interesting question to think about. Okay. So what we're going to move on to now is to look at the level of the Rishonim of kind of where do the chips fall, right? We saw on the one hand we have a Sifra and an Avot Rabbi Natan. We saw on the other hand we have a Yerushalmi and the opinion of Rabbi Padat. Okay? So how do the halachic thinkers rule? Is there an independent prohibition to not coming near or not? Okay? And there's a very famous dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban that we'll look at. Okay, so it begins with the Sefer HaMitzvot LaRambam, which is a book where the Rambam lists all of the mitzvot, all of the positive commandments, all of the negative commandments, And the negative commandment, number 353, is what we're going to look at. Hamitzvah Hashin Nun Gimel, Ki Shehizkiranu Mikrov Le'echat Mikol Elu Ha'arayot Ve'afilu Belo Bi'ah. Okay? The 353rd mitzvah is that we are prohibited from coming near to any of the arayot, even without actual intercourse. Kigon chibuk uneshika v'adomeh lahem mipeulot haznut. Okay? Such as hugging, kissing, and I don't know how I translate it, promiscuous activities that are similar to them. V'hu amaro yit'ale b'azhara mizeh, ish ish al kol she'er b'saro lo tikrivu legalot erva, ki'ilu yomar lo tikrivu mehen kiruv yavi legilui erva. Okay, so the Rambam says that there is a negative commandment, a biblical commandment against coming near, hugging, kissing, other promiscuous activities. And he includes this in the pasuk where it says, a person shall not come near any of their kin to uncover their nakedness. And he says, and this is, it's a little bit difficult to translate when it says, ki'ilu yomar, it says if to say, lo tikrivu mehen, kiruv yavi legalot erva. Don't come near to them. The coming near will lead to the uncovering of nakedness. Okay? So the question can kind of come in there. Well, is not coming near an independent prohibition? Or is not coming near only prohibited in the ways that it will actually lead to an uncovering of nakedness? Okay, in terms of like, what is the scope of the prohibition of not coming near? The Rambam then quotes the Sifra, right, who says that there are these two separate prohibitions, don't come near and don't actually have sex. And then the last part of the Rambam that I wanted us to see is the last two lines, where he says, V'sham amru, okay, and there it was stated, and he's going to quote now the other pasuk that we saw from Leviticus, that those people who violate the arayot will receive the punishment of karet. Ma Talmud lomar, right? What is this trying to teach us? Lefi she'ne'emar lo tikrivu yachol yu chayavin karet al hakreva. Right? Once it said that you're not allowed to come near, might it be that we would be that one would be liable to the punishment of karet even after just coming near? Talmud lomar ha'osot lo ha'krevot. Okay, but the Rambam says, no. We don't go that far because the pasuk says those who actually do these prohibitions will receive karet. So it's only those who actually complete the transgression and not just those who come near. Okay, so even though coming near is an independent biblical prohibition, it is not going to make one liable to karet. Karet is only achieved at the point when one finishes the prohibition in actually having intercourse. Yeah?
That's a bit of a value judgment, I think. I'm wondering if you think the Rambam sees the prohibition as the lewd activity in itself, or the instrumental purpose that lewd activity might lead to. Practical difference being, today the remarkable things one could do with technology, where it's clear that the two people can never, they're far apart, right, across the world, and they could be very lewd via technology.
Right. I mean, the Rambam, and we'll see part of this elsewhere, but looking at the Rambam, definitely he comes across in more places than one as an ascetic. In other words, the Rambam is not someone who was such a fan of sex, even within marriage, certainly outside of it. And I think even the way that he talks, when talking about the prohibitions, chibuk u'neshika, hugging and kissing, v'adomeh lahem mipeulot haznut, even using that term, is already putting a certain, it's casting a certain light upon it. The way that the Rambam is interpreted by most is that those prohibitions, those actions become objectively prohibited biblically. In other words, even if they don't actually lead to the final step of intercourse, one has still violated that step of lo tikrivu, of not coming near. Okay? So one hasn't gotten to the level of a prohibition of karet, but they have still violated a biblical prohibition. Right? And we'll see in a few minutes, the Rambam will clarify a bit more kind of various items, you know, on the ladder, what stands where in terms of level of prohibition. Okay? Yeah.
To me, it a little bit seems like the Rambam is, I think, struggling with, reality and what people, are more inclined or not inclined to do by separating out the al-tikrav as, you shouldn't do it, and, it's prohibited, but, you don't get carried for it. To me, if you have this whole list of prohibitions, and included in this list of prohibitions is lo-tikrav, but that prohibition you don't get carried for, it seems to me maybe he's trying to, resolve something that's, people hug and they kiss more often, I would think, than people are having sex with each other.
So the thing is, I'll tell you, I'm not a historian, and being married to a historian, I'm very aware that I'm not one, so I don't want to say what was happening in the Rambam's time. Was hugging and kissing then like it is today? I don't know. I really don't know. The way that I would see the Rambam here, in terms of why he separates that out for karet, is a hermeneutical issue. The fact that it says specifically, v'nichrutu ha'nefashot ha'osot, right, what does it mean to do, right? So he, I guess, sees that as kind of the final, the final violation, as opposed to...
To me it seems like nitpicky, hugging
right.
is an action, and kissing is an action.
Right. But the thing is, we see even the psukim themselves make that distinction between gilui erva, sexual intercourse, and lo tikrivu. There's a distinction between that act versus what comes before it. And we'll see in the Rambam, in a couple of minutes, the way that he codifies that difference in terms of, okay, this action is going to result in this level of prohibition, and this action is this level. Okay, because he orders it pretty clearly. Yeah?
I might not have been listening properly, so shut me up if you like. Would this be hugging and kissing, even if it was totally not sexually motivated for the rabbi?
Okay.
If it was totally saying hi.
So that's a great question. Here, he doesn't talk about the motivation. We'll come back to the question of motivation in a couple of minutes when we look at the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, because there he does say something which kind of gets to that question. Yeah.
Is the Rambam ruling like the source in Avot Rabbi Natan, that this is the fence? The Kirva's defense, it sounds like the same thing.
Yeah. And the Rambam is basing himself, he explicitly is basing himself on the Sifra, but I think also definitely basing himself on the Avot D'Rabbi Natan, even just from the examples that he brings. Okay. Let's move forward to the Ramban. Okay, the Ramban is going to argue with the Rambam, okay, which is kind of a given, because he makes hasagot, he makes comments on the Rambam, and he'll only comment when he wants to argue. If he agrees, he just, doesn't say anything. Okay? So the Ramban begins, and here what I did was, the translation is just the underlined portion. Okay? He starts out by quoting the Rambam, and then he says as follows. This is where I've underlined. V'hinei harav matza habraita hazu hamefureshet, v'talad varav b'ilan gadol. Okay? The Rambam found this explicit braita, he's referring here to the Midrash, the Sifra, and he hung his words on a tall tree. Okay? Now, this is one of the insults that the Rishonim, use to hurl at each other. Okay? So you want to say that his logic was flawed, and I don't know if there's any English idiom that's similar to this, but we say he hung his words on a tall tree, meaning it just doesn't work. The logic doesn't add up. Okay? And this is an insult that's used frequently amongst the various Rishonim. Okay? And the reason, okay, and he says, Aval kefi ha'iyun b'talmud ein hadavar kein sheyeh b'kreva she'ein ba gilui erva kegon chibuk v'nishuk lav u'malkot. He says, if we look in the Gemara, we'll see that it's not so, okay? It's not so that when one comes near, okay, such as hugging and kissing, one violates a biblical prohibition, okay? Now, the way that the Ramban proves this is by going back to the Gemara in Shabbat that we looked at on page 13a, and he says, basically, the opinion of Rabbi Padat is broad. Now, if the Sifra, which the Rambam quotes, was so clearly accepted as halakha, then the Gemara should have brought that Sifra to challenge Rabbi Padat and said, okay, the position of Rabbi Padat is now removed. Okay? In other words, the Sifra is saying there are two independent prohibitions. Don't come near and don't uncover the nakedness. Rabbi Padat is saying there's only one prohibition of just uncovering the nakedness. So the Ramban is making, I mean, it's a good argument on one level. On the other level, it's an argument from absence. He's saying the Gemara should have said this, but it didn't. But that's really his argument, which is Rabbi Padat, if the Sifra was accepted by the sages of the Talmud, then they would have brought it and used it to shoot down and eliminate the position of Rabbi Padat. But because the position of Rabbi Padat, as we discussed earlier, is allowed to remain standing, that must mean that that Sifra was not taken so seriously. Okay? Yeah.
Is it possible they didn't have that Sifra?
That's a good question.
What was the question?
He says, is it possible they didn't have that Sifra? Okay, the Amoraim didn't have, right, every single text. Also, there were a lot of Braitot that were out there. Not every Braita was known by everyone. It's a good point to make against the Ramban. He goes on to say, he also brings examples. He brings the example of Ula and of other Amoraim, right? With Ula, we saw it with him kissing his sisters. With other Amoraim, we see in Masechet Ketubot, we see Amoraim who are carrying kalot on their shoulders, right, and dancing with them at their wedding. So he brings that example also later on to say, if this was a true biblical prohibition, then clearly the Amoraim would not be lax with it. Okay, the fact that we see Amoraim having physical contact either with their sister or with the kala is yet another proof that this must not be a biblical prohibition. Yeah.
Was the kala asur at that point, or was that before?
Well, she's an arusa, so yes.
Oh, she's, okay, so you're in advance.
Yeah. Yeah. What?
Sorry, but it would still be rabbinic in nature, prohibition.
Right, okay, so now we're going to read
He
says. Yeah. And he says, and this is actually also interesting, he says, I'm skipping now to the next point, which is underlined, the kevan shelo asuchein, okay, because the rabbis of the Talmud didn't reject the position of Rabbi Padat. Navin mehem ki etzlam zeha isur midirabanan. Okay, because Rabbi Padat's position was not thrown out, we can understand that this prohibition is only rabbinic in nature, and that the pasuk is an asmachta be'alma. Okay, the pasuk is simply something that's being leaned on to give their words more weight, but it's not that this pasuk is the origin of an actual prohibition or an additional prohibition. Okay? So we see here the Rambam's position, lo tikrav, don't come near, is an actual biblical prohibition for which one would receive lashes, as if you violate any negative biblical commandment. According to the Ramban, it is a rabbinic prohibition at most.
Lashes and karis. Oh, no, only for...
Okay, just a rabbinic prohibition. Questions? Okay. So that is the dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban. What I wanted to see after that, but this is something that we're only going to see according to the Rambam, because the Ramban, even though he says this is a rabbinic prohibition, he doesn't flesh out the exact content of the rabbinic prohibition the same way that the Rambam fleshes out what is the content of the biblical prohibition. Okay? So at this point, we're just going to look at the Rambam and see kind of how does he define what actions would constitute a violation of Lo Tikrivu. And in seeing that, we will also see kind of a ladder in which he builds a hierarchy of what actions are forbidden and to what extent. Oh, great. Okay, and I can put it up on the board. Okay, so the Rambam, and this is in Hilchot Yisurei Bi'ah Perek Chaf Aleph, a really great chapter to look at if you want kind of one place where the Rambam talks about a lot of different sexual violations. It's here, Perek Chaf Aleph. We'll actually come back to this in 2 weeks from now. We talk about masturbation. Just a few halachot later, the Rambam deals with that. He also deals with the parameters of married sexuality in this very same chapter. So it's an interesting chapter to look at. Okay, so he starts off by saying, Kol haba al erva min ha'arayot derech ivarim. Okay, anyone who has sex with one of the arayot, what's known as derech ivarim. Okay, derech ivarim in English will be translated as interfemoral sex, which means when two people, they could even have their clothes on, are rubbing against each other, but there is no penetration involved. Okay, this also, derech ivarim, would also be something that could refer to oral sex. Okay, o shechibek v'nishek derech ta'ava v'nehene b'kiruv basar. So here's where it comes back to your point, okay? Or that he hugs and kisses in a desirous way and feels pleasure with this contact. Hareze loket min haTorah. This person will receive lashes for violating a biblical commandment. Shene'emar, as it says, lebilti asot michukot ha-toevot, v'ne'emar lo tikrivu legalot erva. Okay, so he quotes these psukim and he says, based on the psukim, don't come near to uncovering the nakedness. Don't do any of these violations that are mentioned in chapter 18 of Leviticus. It means that one should not come near to doing anything that will lead to the actual uncovering of nakedness. Now, two points that I want to make here. One is that when we talk about the question of, is there such a thing as neutral physical contact, right? What about today, let's say, something like the handshake that happens in the business context? This Rambam is a very relevant source, okay? Because the Rambam here says, derech ta'ava. He limits the actions, right? So I would say that kol haba al erva min ha'arayot derech evarim, having this type of interfemoral sex, oral sex, I think that that's something that's obviously a sexual action, and I don't think anyone would ever come and say that doing that in the business context is okay. even though it has actually been done, but, you know, many years ago. But specifically with chibuk and nishuk, hugging and kissing, which are actions that are more open to interpretation and are actions that can be done with different people and have different meanings, okay? He specifically says, derech ta'ava, okay? So there are those, and there is a machloket in the Achronim over whether what gets to be called derech chiba, an affectionate manner, is needed, okay? Just to throw out there a couple of sources, the Bash, the Beit Shmuel, one of the Achronim, says that according to the Ramban's reading of the Rambam, derech chiba, doing something in a desirous manner, an affectionate manner, is not needed, and the actions would be prohibited even if they were done in a totally neutral context. Okay, the Shach says no. Because the Rambam says derech ta'ava, it shows that the context is important and it needs to be done in an affectionate context, in a sexual context. Okay? later on, more contemporary response to the Shu'at B'nai Banim, Rav Henkin, talks about the fact that the same action can sometimes be okay and sometimes not, and that here the Rambam establishes a difference based on context and not action. Okay, and this is one of the sources that he uses in making the argument that the handshake is okay. Okay, or the handshake in the business context is okay. He might still say, even though the handshake is okay in the business context, a handshake with someone that you're involved in a relationship with would not be okay. Okay, because there the context would show that it's not simply kind of devoid of feeling. Okay, but this is really the place where that question comes up. Yeah.
No, also just in a normal social context, if you do it in the business world, because the business world is sort of separated from the religious world.
Right.
If you're in that circle and you're at a Shabbos meal, you wouldn't shake hands with somebody else's
right.
wife.
Well, the thing is, it becomes a multi-layered question. It's not a question that we have time to get into tonight in terms of what are the exact parameters of derech chiba, and is there a difference also between derech ta'ava, right, in a desirous manner versus derech chiba in an affectionate manner, right? In other words, you can have someone that you're dealing with in the business context where you shake their hand and there are good feelings on both sides, right? You know, you've just sold me your house. That's a great thing. I'm really happy. You're really happy. There's a good vibe kind of going back and forth. But the question of kind of where do we draw the line between the good vibe versus the sexual vibe versus the affectionate, some people will make those distinctions, others will not. I don't remember whose opinion this is, but I once heard someone saying that, and it could have just been the opinion of a contemporary rabbi, saying that any context in which you don't actually feel hate towards the person is derech chiba. So I'm saying there's a spectrum in terms of how it can get read. But one point that I also want to make is that phrase of derech ta'ava is not mentioned by the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvot. It's only mentioned by the Rambam here. So again, the question can come up, and the opinion of the Beit Shmuel, that it's not actually even significant, okay? And that the actions would be prohibited regardless, okay?
Sorry, can
you
just say which
opinion? Yeah, okay, and I'm sorry that I don't have the exact sources. I can bring it next time, but the Beit Shmuel, okay, is saying that according to the Ramban's reading of the Rambam, derech chiba, an affectionate manner of the touch, is not needed. Even if the touch is without any affectionate at all, it will still violate a biblical prohibition. Okay, and this actually has major ramifications. It's a discussion in Hilchot Nidah that I won't get into. I'll just mention it kind of parenthetically. The question of a husband who's a doctor taking his wife's pulse when she's not feeling well or when she's in a situation of danger. There are those who would say that according to the Ramban, that cannot be done, and that it's even Yaharag Bal Yavor, something that the person should die rather than have the husband taking her pulse. Because if you see this as a really Isur D'Oraita, that's how it gets taken. And there she is actually his menstruating wife. The Shach is who I mentioned, who says that derech chiba, an affectionate manner to the touch, is needed to violate the biblical prohibition. And then I also made reference to the Shu'at B'nai Banim, which is more contemporary, response of Rav Henkin, that talks about the context being what's important and not the action itself.
Question.
Okay. Yeah.
What does he do with the words derech ta'ava if that's not significant?
Right. So that's not something which I'm going to enter into too much. All that I'm pointing out right now is just that there's a tension between here where he says it and the Sefer HaMitzvot where he doesn't say it. So the question could just be, well, which source are we going to look at as where the Rambam is explaining what exactly it takes to violate the D'Oraita? And he seems to be saying two different things in the two sources where he talks about it. So on a textual level, I would say that that's the tension.
But he doesn't deal with touching. He deals with chibuk anisha.
Right, okay. Now still,
so
that's
the,
right.
Getting to the pulse is a completely different issue.
Right, right. Okay, but the way that it gets taken, okay, at least according to the Ramban's reading of the Rambam, and many other Rishonim read the Rambam, and Chronim read the Rambam this way, as these are examples, okay, and then we also have the irony that these very sexual actions, such as interfemoral sex, let's say oral sex, because I think it's more kind of in the common parlance, and hugging and kissing, and maybe even just the handshake or the taking of the pulse, are suddenly all falling into the same category. That's a very wide spectrum. Okay? Yeah.
I don't want to be nitpicky about the Rambam, like the question of whether the husband can check the nidda, wifey nidda's pulse.
Right.
According to that, like, train of thought, another male doctor could, but the husband couldn't because they had that relationship in general.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Right. So that would be one.
You
weren't
able to do it, but you could do it yourself.
Right, right. But it's an extreme example that gets brought, but also raises, totally not connected, the interesting question for me of what then creates meaning to the actions. Like, I know for me as a student, learning that, it then in some way eroticized the taking of the pulse, right, which is something these days, I guess it's not even done as much. But suddenly reading about it as this action that's Yehareg Val Yavor, suddenly it's like, oh wow, I had never thought of that action in that way before. But somehow the text can create a certain meaning around an otherwise neutral action.
On the face of it, isn't the Rambam specifically mentioning these particularly sexual or intimate acts in Aleph? And in base, he's going into things that are less intimate in nature.
So let's...
Probably it's maybe Aser Bal Pater. You won't get whipped for it.
Let's look at Bet and then we'll see. But one of the things that we're going to see is that the Rambam is not going to mention everything, and there are certain things where it's going to need to be decided. Does this fit into Aleph or Bet? Right? He doesn't mention every possible action that can get done. Okay. So that is Aleph. Okay. The Rambam's definition of violating an Isur Doraita. We'll move now to Bet, where he says, "Ve'asur la'adam likrotz bi'adav uberaglav olir moz be'enav le'achat min harayot." And it is prohibited for a man to... I'm trying to see the exact example, literally, to motion with his hands, to motion with his feet, or to gesture with his eye, which is like to wink. Okay, to one of the arayot, v'kein l'sachekima o l'hakel rosh, and similarly to be flirtatious with her. All of these activities, okay, the gesturing with the hands, the feet, the winking, are all kind of subsumed into a type of flirtatious activity. Okay, the Rambam says that is prohibited. V'afilu l'hariach b'samim she'aleha o l'habit b'yofya asur. Even to smell her perfume or to gaze at her beauty is prohibited. Umakin hamitkaven ledavar ze makat mardut. Okay? And someone who violates this will receive makat mardut, which is lashes that you get not for violating a biblical prohibition, but for violating a rabbinic prohibition. Okay? So we see here are that flirtatious actions which don't involve any physical contact, even those are rabbinically prohibited. Yeah?
If you're a single man, what makes a single woman ariyot?
Like, nida.
So how could you ever establish a relationship with them if you can't enjoy their beauty? Or
how can you date, according to...
Right, how can you date in the modern world? That's a very big question. And an interesting question, I mean, I can think of an answer to it, is why has this halakha in the Rambam been forgotten? Okay? In some ways, right? Dating isn't prohibited. And I think a certain amount of flirtation in the dating context isn't generally prohibited. But yet, the first halakha, which is, I would say, the origin of Shomer Negiya, gets taken much more seriously. And we could say, well, look, one of them is rabbinic, and one of them is biblical. Or we can say that culturally, you know, it's not possible to enforce the second, whereas the first has become more possible. But I don't know. Yeah.
So if we establish that both men and women are responsible for keeping these rules, does that mean that a woman's responsible for not wearing perfume and covering up her beauty and making sure that a man, like, Is that the next step?
No, you know what? It's not the next step. I don't know of it getting taken to that place. In other words, the laws of tzniut, right, of modesty, of how women should dress, are one thing. But to take it to the next level of saying, don't wear perfume so that the perfume not be smelled, is not taken at this level. In other words, it could be there are contemporary rabbis who are saying that type of thing, but that's not where the Rambam takes it. Okay? And he then goes on to say, oh wow, okay, our time is going to be up in like 2 minutes. I'm not gonna read the rest of it inside then. What I'll do is just sum it up. Basically, he talks about a certain type of gazing that's prohibited, okay? But then in Halacha Gimel, he says that there is a dispensation to look at an unmarried woman, literally to check her out, so that one could see if she is pleasing in his eyes and he wants to marry her. Okay, so just in terms of when it seemed that the Rambam was becoming kind of too strict to live with, he does have a dispensation of an unmarried man looking at an unmarried woman to see if she is pretty to him. Okay, but he clearly says of a lo yistakel derech znut, but he shouldn't look in a lewd manner. Okay, so again, and this is something that has been discussed. Totally separate discussion of what are the different levels of looking, gazing, leering, okay? Those all have different statuses halachically, okay? What I want to just end off with before we conclude is at least giving a sense of, according to the Rambam, what would a ladder of forbidden touch look like, okay? So what I would say is this. The first level, he says, looking at an unmarried woman to see if one wants to marry her is totally permissible. Okay? Now, along with that, there are some, okay, who would say that there is also a type of neutral touch, such as the handshake. Okay? Not such as the handshake, let's leave it at just the handshake. Okay? That is permitted, even according to the Rambam. That's something that's under dispute, okay? The next level, and here we're already talking about things that are forbidden, is flirtatious behavior that doesn't involve any physical contact. According to the Rambam, that is a rabbinic prohibition, okay? Moving yet another level more severe, okay, is the bi'ad derech ivarim, the interfemoral sex, oral sex, hugging, kissing, which the Rambam lumps all together as an isur de'oraita, a biblical prohibition. According to many, this is where regular touch would come in also. The final level, which we don't see here, but I'll give you the source. I'm sorry, I forgot to put it in. This is in the Rambam, Hilchot Isurei Biyah, chapter 1, Halacha 10, okay, Aleph Yud, okay, where the Rambam says, okay, what does it take to get to the next level to violate the Isur Karet, okay, the prohibition with the Karet punishment, and that is having sexual intercourse, either bi'a kedarka, vaginal intercourse, or bi'a shelo kedarka, anal intercourse, and having either of those simply at the act of partial penetration without even necessarily finishing the penetration, the karet prohibition is violated. Okay? And that is with regard to nida, the menstruating woman. It's also with regard to all the rest of the arayot. Right? So that is kind of the basic hierarchy that we can build based on the Rambam. I think it's important to know it. I think it's also interesting to know it. Anecdotally, several years ago, someone tried to publish an article that was refused about the prevalence of anal sex in certain singles communities where people were trying to avoid violation of the Isur Karet, and were having anal sex because they thought that that was better. In fact, if they had opened up the Rambam, Hilchot Yisurei Biyah, Perek Aleph, Halacha Yud, they would see that there is no difference between vaginal and anal sex. The only thing that would actually be different is oral sex, or this interfemoral intercourse, which is not actually the Yisur Karet, but a level, one level less severe than that of an Yisur Doraita, a biblical prohibition. Okay? The last source on the sheet, which you could take a look at, and the truth is we'll really come back to it next week, this Tshuva of the Rivash, is the question of whether the prohibition of Nida applies to an unmarried woman at all. Okay, the Rivash asks an interesting question because he says, whenever we find the halachic sources, the Rishonim, talking about the Nida violations, it's always in the context of Ishto Nida, of his wife who is a Nida. So could it be that an unmarried woman doesn't, you know, there is no prohibition of Nida with an unmarried woman at all? And the Rivash ends up saying, no, the answer is clear. Sex with a menstruating woman is forbidden, whether she is his wife, whether she is his friend's wife, whether she is unmarried. And this is clear, and no one ever doubted it. Speaking about it is unnecessary. But I did want you to see, we'll see the rest of the Rivash next time, that he did raise the question. And he's not the only one who raised the question. Another one of the Achronim, the Torah HaShlamim, also raises that question. In Yoredeya, because he says the logic that's given for Nida doesn't apply to an unmarried woman, so maybe really it should just apply to a married woman. The question gets raised a couple of times, but generally kind of shot down. Okay, so those are really just the tip of the iceberg, some kind of basic sources on this topic of Shomer Negia. If anyone has any questions, feel free to come over and ask. Have a great week. Right, okay, so that's a separate, so that is a separate question. Right.